Actually, I have no idea how to start this episode of the show. We should just start the music. Just, you know,
movies, foul threat.
Welcome to the Film Threat Podcast. I am Chris Gore, joined by Anthony Ray Bench.
How's it going, everybody?
And we've got I would describe this as a potpourri episode of the show. Not in the sense that
it'll cover the scent of shit.
it may actually make things smell better in some sense. It'll add some fragrance to your life because we have basically just a variety of movies to talk about and even some television. And this episode's going to sound like it's all over the place, but it's because really you and I have not done a traditional episode of the show where you and I just talk about films and potentially some TV because there's crossover with TV. We've talked about Twin Peaks a couple times on the podcast.
Game of Thrones
we've talked about and Star Trek. And it's really because those big franchises, Game of Thrones has never been in theaters, but they're sort of cross-cultural experience. They're cross-medium experiences, maybe also cross-cultural. We're trying to record a lot of podcasts at one time because as you are hearing this, I will be at New York Comic Con, and I'm actually not doing anything there other than attending. It was a last-minute thing, so I'm going to the con, and I'm just going to be hanging out at New York Comic Con. That's what...
I'm calling bullshit. I guarantee by the end of the convention, you're going to be on a fucking panel.
I'll probably be on a panel. Panel or a podcast where I run into someone who'll say, oh, can I ask you to... Which will be fine. I'm happy to do it. But let's... First of all, before we get into this variety episode of the podcast where we'll talk about some recent television and movies, we have to plug our upcoming episode of the Film Threat Podcast live at LA Podfest here in Los Angeles.
I cannot wait for this.
I can't wait. It's Sunday, October 8th at noon. And last episode, I actually got the date wrong, October 9th, but who cares? Okay. Sunday, October 8th at noon at LA Podfest in the Gold Room at the historic Biltmore Hotel in Los Angeles. You can just get information at lapodfest.com. But I'm calling this the giant size episode of the Film Threat Podcast with myself, Anthony, and a whole bunch of guests. Here's the lineup so far. Hal Sparks, actor, comedian. Love him. Yeah. Dante James, actor, producer, a friend of mine that you need to discover. This guy, Dante James, he's a true talent. John Bailey, the epic voice guy
in a world,
you've heard him on YouTube. Yoshi Obayashi, comedian and friend of ours.
Love Yoshi.
Kate Reese Davies, who's a director, producer, actress. Andrew Kevin Walker, who's the writer behind Seven. You might have seen that movie, Seven. And
love
he also did an animated film called Nerdland, which we'll talk to him about. And Jessica Cameron, who's an actress, producer, and director. You can get info about the live Film Threat podcast at lapodfest.com. It's a giant size edition of the show, and I really hope you get to make it. And I think I might have overbooked it, but this is, to play it safe, some of these people are going to drop out. I guarantee drop out and we'll get replacements. So it should be a lot of fun. We also, before we get right into it, we need to thank our sponsor. We have a sponsor for the Film Threat Podcast. Okay. And first of all, I'm excited because I really feel that a lot of the people who are listeners would benefit from our sponsor, videoblocks.com. And if you go to videoblocks.com/filmthreat, you're actually going to help support this show. You're going to support the website, and you're going to get a great deal for yourself. Anthony, tell us about VideoBlocks.
I mean, it's the premier website for stock footage, not only stock footage, but studio quality stock footage. They're always constantly updating their library. And also, this is really, really handy for a podcast producer, such as myself. There's a lot of sound effects. You can use sound effects for podcast production. There's video background. It's perfect for filmmakers.
Right. It's stock footage, but it's also stock audio and additionally tools for special effects makers, like After Effects and whatnot. It's $149 for a year.
That's a steal.
It's a steal. You can get a trial. So try it out. Like I do trial subscriptions with a lot of things, right?
Oh, I do too. And then I change my email address and then redo it.
Well, don't do that. Don't do that with VideoBlocks. Just go to videoblocks.com/filmthreat. Sign up for the trial.
It's worth it.
Sign up for a year for $149. It's a deal, and you'll have access to an entire library of stock footage to use in your film and audio productions and your YouTube videos and all of that. And we really thank the folks at VideoBlocks for helping us out.
Spell it out, Chris.
It's VideoBlocks.com/filmthreat. Okay. So is that in the copy? Does it say to spell it out?
It does.
All right. Okay. Well, we're going to do that every episode now. You guys are going to be sick of it, but that's okay. All right. So let's get right into it because we have a huge list of things to go through.
Yes.
Where do we start? Because we haven't done a podcast like this in a while.
Okay. I will tell you exactly where to start. So we got, I wouldn't necessarily call it fan mail. Just a really, really nice email from a filmmaker.
First of all, I think you're lying.
Okay.
We never get nice email. It's always someone who's mad at us.
Yeah.
Or we get, here's the emails I get is, can you change your review of my movie? Or can you delete this
thing?
Take
it down,
like,
yeah.
And I'm like, no, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to change anything on the site. So.
Well, this time we got a really nice email from filmmaker Jerry J. White III. He was the filmmaker that did, he was the director that did This Is Us, a movie that I really, really enjoyed. We talked about it a couple podcasts ago.
No, first of all, the description of it, I think is absolutely brilliant. I'm dying to see it myself. And it's unfortunately, the This Is Us is this, it's the same title of a network television show.
A very popular one.
Very popular network television show, the same name. So if you Google This Is Us, it's going to be really hard to find. They might want to consider changing that title, upgrading in some way.
Well,
I don't know. Is it too late? It's already out.
Yeah.
Of course it's too late.
But thank you, Jerry White III. Really appreciate it.
I think he reached out to us on Twitter too and was very grateful both for the podcast mention and for the article that appeared on the website.
Yeah,
which just goes to show, why are you listening to this podcast? You should be reading the website, or actually, you know what? Do both.
They're listening because they love us, Chris.
Right, right.
Yeah.
This is the highlights, because if you don't read the website on a regular basis, the podcast kind of gives you the highlights of what's on the website, and then you can go to the website to check out the latest reviews.
Yeah. But another filmmaker that's been really, really kind, showing us his gratitude is our friend, Joe McLean. So thank you, Joe.
So you're saying we're getting nice letters from filmmakers?
We are.
This is unusual.
Yeah.
This doesn't happen.
Yeah.
Well,
so,
it's happening.
Makes me feel warm and fuzzy.
Okay, so now that we've gotten that out of the way,
mm-hmm.
we have fan mail, oddly. Let's get into so many things. I have a huge list, and I don't even know where to start. Like, I'll tell you what I want to talk about.
Yeah?
Star Trek Discovery.
Okay.
Okay, so there are people online that do not like this show. And I'll say, as a longtime Star Trek fan, and I started with the original series,
mm-hmm.
I watched Star Trek The Next Generation. You know, it was sort of, it was rough going at the first season of Next Gen. It wasn't until it got to like third season, end of second season, third season, it got really good.
Yeah, I would say
good.
Second season is where second season started, I started getting
so,
on board.
So I don't think there's hardly, look, the thing that Star Trek fans love more than a new Star Trek series is complaining about a new Star Trek series. So, but let's start from the top. I'm going to just spell it out. I love the show.
Really?
For a number of reasons. One, it's epic. It's the special effects and the look and the design. It's the best looking Star Trek has ever been design wise. The uniforms are taken from where Enterprise ended. And it's obviously sort of leading up to what the original series uniforms will be. Of course, we've seen in J.J. Abrams' Trek. But this Trek looks better than, I believe, the Abrams Trek in terms of the special effects design and whatnot. The casting, the most diverse cast we've seen in a Star Trek series. In fact, if you look through all the characters, it's about 50-50 men and women.
Oh, wow.
With a lot of aliens that are on the show, which we don't know what their gender is and who cares in the future. right? But so there's that aspect. You've got female captain, great. Another, we've got the female first officer named Michael, a female, who was brought up by Vulcans. Her character has a past that I believe is going to play into things. And then you've got like this, it's not a traditional Star Trek series where, because this would have been the easy thing for them to do. Call it the ship called Enterprise. Mm-hmm. And there's a crew and there's the wackity this and the robot that and whatever. And they go to a planet and there's a problem and they solve the problem. Goodbye. I feel good about things. They're not doing that. This show is long form storytelling. So they've basically the first few episodes that we've seen, because I got the CBS app and we'll discuss that in a bit. It's long form storytelling. This is on the level of things don't wrap up in an episode. Mm-hmm. This is a story arc that's going to take the full season. It feels more like an HBO show than a CBS show. Feels more like HBO or, you know, Showtime. I mean, this and the budget behind it, it feels a lot like a Westworld or a Game of Thrones in the sense that it takes itself very seriously. I think previous Star Treks have always had the wackity wah winking there, you know, like a little ending that like makes you're supposed to laugh.
Yeah.
It's and yeah, so none of that is part of this. I mean, this is the outbreak of intergalactic war, and it really is. There's this whole thing with the Klingons, which I want to discuss the Klingons for a second. And this is, I say this to all my friends who are hardcore Star Trek fans that are like, the Klingons don't look like the Klingons from the original series. Well, when they made Star Trek the Motion Picture, those Klingons didn't look like the Klingons from the original show,
yeah,
which
they
were basically
way cooler.
Yeah, they look way cooler. Basically, the Klingons from the original Star Trek series were just dark skinned and hairy. You know, I mean, so that's
Didn't have the ridges.
Didn't have the ridges. They added the ridges in motion picture. And in this, here's what I'll say on this. What I love about the Klingon thread in this, which is all subtitled, is it's really about nationalism. It's a lot about what's happening in our culture today, right? So, but what's interesting about it is the costumes, which I think are ornate and actually beautiful and intricate for this incarnation of the Klingons. In the story, Klingons have only encountered humans a few times. So here's what I would compare it to. And just, this is coming from someone not only who's an old school Star Trek fan, but I used to read science fiction novels when I was a kid, like Isaac Asimov's Foundation series, the Dune books, also just a lot of other cheesy sci-fi stuff, but I'm a reader of science fiction.
Yeah.
And what I love about science fiction is science fiction thinks deeply about, you know, about all aspects of a story in terms of political, science, social, all of those things are weighed. And that's why I'm comparing this to something along the lines of Westworld and Game of Thrones. So just think about in our own history on the planet Earth, right? If you went to Japan, right, before Japan encountered Western culture, it was effectively feudal Japan.
Yeah.
Right? They dressed in outfits that did not match the rest of the world. Then, having gotten a taste of Western culture, Japan integrated some aspects of Western culture into its own culture and dressed more traditionally like people on the rest of the planet Earth. So I will say to you, the Klingons that have these very different looking outfits have only encountered humans a few times, and they look really weird because they're not like Klingons as we have known them. It's because the creators behind the show thought very deeply about every aspect of this. What are they supposed to do? Wear shoes? Why is it that every time they go to a planet, it's like the planet of where everyone wears a beige jumper? Like, it's ridiculous, right?
Yeah.
It makes no sense whatsoever. So I
do have a question.
Yes, yes.
So I know
I'm raving about this show because just based on the first few episodes that I've seen, I just want to be clear. I love where it's going. I think there's going to be some episodes that meander. I think there's going to be some, it's just set the stage for what I think will end up being the best and the smartest Star Trek series ever done.
Oh, wow.
This is just based on my impressions and what I know from, I know a few people who've seen some things in the future. But all I'm saying is I've only seen the first few and I'm riveted. It's even the down to the title sequence, every detail about the show. And I really have to give CBS credit for saying, we want to do Star Trek right. They're doing it on a movie level. I mean, this is movie level quality, the acting and the casting. Oh my God, Doug Jones is so good. Doug Jones, who I've run into at so many conventions, and he's one of the sweetest, nicest people you could ever run into, is so good as his alien character, whose name escapes me. I'm still learning the show, but I do think there is one fatal flaw.
What's that?
The medium.
Okay. And by that, right.
It's on the CBS app. There's no, look, I'm a guy, now I've learned, like, I just sort of surf apps. Like I canceled my Showtime subscription after I finished watching Billions and Twin Peaks because I was done.
Yeah.
Right? I'll sign up again when Billions comes back, but I'll probably wait until it's like halfway done, right? So, or I'll binge watch it and whatnot. So this is I think that this is a problem because traditionally we have been trained that CBS I associate with free, right? CBS is something I've watched CBS on television since I was a kid. You probably have too.
Yeah, well, I associate with shitty sitcoms and like procedural, like CSI. Yes. Like that stuff that I don't watch.
Crappy shows like Two and a Half Men. That
stuff,
like,
that's not really my thing.
Give me a headache. Exactly. Yeah. So yeah, but there's, look, CBS also has like a storied history of a lot of great programming as well. You should. There's great things on MASH, you know. Which Letterman. One day, maybe they'll make MASH into a movie.
I hope not.
Of course. Please. The Robert Altman movie's genius. All right, so...
Oh, yeah, that's right. It did start as a movie.
It was a movie.
I thought you were talking about like one of those reboots that they're doing where they make MASH, it like a quasi-comedy MASH like was they did a movie, Baywatch.
They made the TV show. Yeah. So the thing is, because we've been trained that CBS is free, we're offended now that they're asking us for money.
Yeah.
So this is why you see this sort of revolt on the internet of people who are not liking the show because of the way it's being rolled out. And I do think that's something of a mistake. What they should have done is that it was the show, Star Trek Discovery, is on CBS with commercials.
Yeah.
And then on the app, which you can pay for, it's commercial free. Because you're paying money. Additionally, it's uncensored, meaning they'll swear. Mm-hmm. And
do they swear?
No, in the first few episodes, at least that I've seen. Mm-hmm. I'm saying you could have that. And then also maybe there would be extras, you know, an after show, deleted scenes, like stuff behind, you know, stuff that would basically just give you extra stuff. So I'm going to stop talking about it because I want to revisit it.
I do have a question.
Yes, sure. So, yes, you can sign into my account.
No, that's not what I wanted. No. Okay. So I know it's a prequel, but do you think it's going to be taking place in the Star Trek Prime universe or the J.J. Abrams universe?
I don't care. I don't care. If it's a great story, it doesn't matter to me. At some point, they'll explain it. This is the thing that people are upset about. At some point, those Klingons, by the end of the show, will be dressed like the Klingons as we know them, right? By the end of Star Trek Discovery, 5, 6, 7, 8 years from now, they'll be dressed in gold and red and blue, right? Like they're you're going to see, this is the evolution. This is the prequel. They're setting the stage, I think. And Michelle Yeoh, who I'm a huge fan of. I mean, I love her.
But I just want to know if they're setting the stage for the original series or the J.J. Abrams movies.
I don't think it matters. I think what they're doing is they're introducing you to a whole new world, which seems to be going the direction of they're focusing on a war between Starfleet and the Klingons. And it's about our times, because how long have we been living with war? I mean, America's just, we're just used to it now. There's no, like, we are at war. We're just, you know, we have troops here, we have troops there. They're fighting this, they're fighting ISIS. We're, you know, we're fighting global climate change. It's just always happening.
Yeah.
You know? So I feel that all of the Star Trek series have been some reflection of their time. Mm-hmm. And I think as when you look back at the original series, I mean, the vision for it was so groundbreaking, and just as groundbreaking as the original series was in the 60s, this series, I believe, is as groundbreaking to today, because it's going to be dealing with issues of today: racism, nationalism, you know, how do we get along with other cultures, right? Like it's in xenophobia. I mean, xenophobia, because they're literally aliens, right?
Yeah.
So I'm ecstatic about it. But I understand the mixed reaction. The mixed reaction is due to the fact that it doesn't look like I want it to look. It's not the Star Trek that I like, that is happy and it's a good ending. This is not like that. This is I don't want to say it's a darker vision, because it's not dark. Let's just say it's more relevant to our current times.
Okay, cool.
There's my Star Trek Discovery rant. And look, on the Film Threat podcast, you get bonus. It's the TV Threat podcast. But let's transition back to movies, because we have quite a few to discuss on this episode.
Yep.
Anthony.
Yes, sir.
Take it away. I talked way too much.
So all right. So this one's been out for a while, but I caught it at the drive-in, and I want to touch upon it briefly. I was really impressed with Annabelle Creation. It's this great film with a talented cast, a really creepy atmosphere, you know, the doll and everything. It's not like Chucky, where the doll's running around and killing people and stuff like that. It's a ghost story. It's basically this little girl gets killed, and these parents are dealing with it. They summon this demon into a doll. They think they're summoning their daughter into the doll. And it's just, it doesn't rely on jump scares, which I am so sick of horror movies, you know, doing the blah thing. That was a big criticism I had with it. This is very much just a tense movie. Like, there's this really cool scene where a little girl sneaks into the dead daughter's room. And she finds the doll, and she puts the doll in the closet. She walks away, and the closet door opens. So she goes back, she shuts the closet door, she walks away, and the closet door just opens again. It's like practical stuff, and it's just really, really effective.
You're saying is there was like a PA behind the door pushing the door open, but it still scared you.
It didn't scare me. It's just creepy and unsettling. Right. I wouldn't say it was scary. I'm a horror pro. But
Norman Gidney, who he does a website called Horror Buzz.
Yeah, I love Norman.
I love horrorbuzz.com, and Norman is actually a contributor to the Film Threat website. He contributes reviews, mm-hmm. and then he lets us post his reviews on our site. He posts his reviews on his own site, and we appreciate it. But he gave it a rave review.
Yeah.
And Norman's like, if you look up his reviews, he pretty much hates but he has really good reasons for disliking the horror. I really do trust his judgment. So to hear that you liked it and he liked it, that one definitely is going to have to go on my Halloween watch list.
It's a fantastic addition to the Conjuring film franchise, which I love. Like, I'm a big fan of the first Conjuring movie. I did not see the first Annabelle movie. I just didn't have an interest in it, and I heard it was crap anyways. One gripe I do have is that this movie should have stood on its own. It should have been almost like a reboot and kind of ignored that crappy movie. There is a sequence at the end that does play off the original. So if you haven't seen the original Annabelle, like I haven't, you kind of get lost. I looked it up online. I wasn't, you know, too like confused. Also, it clumsily sets up another spinoff movie called The Nun.
Wait a second.
Yeah.
So a horror movie ends and sets up another horror movie?
Yeah, a spinoff.
When does this ever happen in a horror movie?
All the fucking time.
Yeah, exactly. That's my point.
Definitely check out Annabelle Creation. I liked it slightly better than it, actually.
I feel like this could be a new segment called Anthony Sees a Movie 6 months after it comes out. That's a new on the podcast.
Yeah,
that'll be our new thing.
Anthony at the drive-in, because that's where I see these movies.
Yeah. And then I see movies on flights. I talked about Wilson.
I want to see that movie so bad.
It's so good. It's so good. Yeah. It definitely fits into that My Name is Doris, where it's just about...
I love those movies.
Yeah, My Name is Doris, Napoleon Dynamite, Wilson. It's strange characters in a normal land, if that makes sense. So now we should talk about, actually, I just want to briefly mention that you were supposed to see a movie called Professor Marston and the Wonder Women.
Yeah.
And had car problems. And I had car problems. Now, did you email the publicist to say, I'm sorry, blah, can I go to the next screening? Because I really want to see that movie. And I don't know. I think it opens this weekend. But what it's about.
No, October 13th.
That's coming up. Yes. Yeah. You know, it depends on when people are listening to this. We have no idea.
That's true. Next week is still going to be a little far off from the 13th.
But this movie, Professor Marston and the Wonder Woman, is about the creation of Wonder Woman and the professor who wrote and created Wonder Woman, but he also created the lie detector, where your sweaty palms, your heartbeat. He invented that, and it's all about the sort of BDSM and fetish relationship he had with two women in his life, his wife, and they had kind of a girlfriend. So it reveals this.
Yeah, he was into polygamy.
Right, exactly. So,
and bondage.
So what I would say, because if you look at the old Wonder Woman comics, which you should just pick up some reprints, it's all like someone gets tied up and that was one of Wonder Woman's weaknesses.
If you bound her,
yeah,
like is that the correct like
bound?
Yeah, like tied her
up. How would I know?
I don't know. if you tied her hands, she would be weak. She would be vulnerable.
Right.
That I'm not making that up. That's
I don't know
thing.
That the DC movie universe version of
they should probably ignore that.
That would get weird. But I'm really excited to see this film. I was hoping you'd seen it, but yeah,
she was also the secretary of the Justice League, so they should probably take that out too.
Oh, that's awful. Yeah. So awful. You look at these things, and they're really like I grew up reading all these like comics, and at the time I read them when I was a little kid. Like, they were relevant to me. And now when I read, like, the first issue of X-Men, which I had, like, X-Men 1 through 100, the first issue is, like, you know, it's reporting for Cyclops reporting for duty, sir. And it's all this weird sort of nerdy, like, Jean Grey being this, oh, gosh. You know, she has, like, a crush on, that Scott Summers has a crush on her. She has a crush on him. But
Oh, golly.
It's, like, it's so, like, innocent, but also, like, really. But that was the times.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, like, I feel like that was like, I feel like it's kind of, it's representative of the times, and I'm glad times have changed. Like,
yes.
This is, I'm glad we're living in the times we are now, but because that's
for the most part.
For the most part.
Let's not get carried away.
Yes. Not all of them. Not the, you know, not with horror. Like, it feels like you can't, the news is like the worst movie you could watch right now because it really just does seem like a horrible freaking disaster movie from everything that's happened in Puerto Rico to Houston, Florida to Twitter, which is gonna start it's not just when someone says you're starting a Twitter war, you could actually start a war.
Yeah,
this is what we're up for. So this is why we escape into the world of TV and movies. So but this movie Professor Marston, I haven't seen it yet, but I'm really dying to see it. But there's a documentary about DC Comics that you'll find if you look on YouTube, because I think it's actually on YouTube. Ryan Reynolds actually narrates this documentary about DC Comics, and it's amazing. They use like archival footage and interviews with creators from the present day, along with footage of creators from the past, and it talks about the beginnings of DC Comics and just how DC and also Marvel is kind of in there as well. But Ryan Reynolds, I think it was like, they released this as like an extra on one of the DVDs I reviewed years ago, but this documentary really stuck with me.
It's called Secret Origin, the story of DC Comics.
Okay, this is a great documentary because
it came out in 2010.
It's a serious documentary about the evolution of DC Comics, but what I love about it is it goes into detail about Professor Marston and his relationship with these two women. And so if you're going to see the Professor Marston narrative movie, you might want to see the documentary first because, I mean, to their credit, DC like completely embraced, you know, that they didn't try to whitewash the history of the creation of the Wonder Woman character. They full on in the documentary explain all of that. And it's awesome. So I've never forgotten that documentary.
It harkens back to a time where we had hopes that Green Lantern was going to be a good movie.
Right. Maybe that's why Ryan Reynolds did the voiceover.
No, that's
the
why he did it. Yeah.
For that. But look, I hope at some point you get to see the movie. I will actually, because I'm not going to be around, I'll see it in the theater at some point, because I really do want to see that one. And I should mention also, I did see It a second time.
I did too.
I enjoyed it much better the second time.
I did not.
I enjoyed it much better. I don't know why. Maybe it was because I knew when the scares were coming. And the thing that I love about that movie, it's not the scares. It's those kids. Those kids are so good. I'm just drawn in. I feel like they're better than the kids in Stranger Things.
I don't know about that.
All right, well, we'll see. Stranger Things season 2 is coming up.
Look, I agree with you. The kids are the best part of that movie. And as a matter of fact, like when I was watching it, like every time Pennywise came up, aside from the first scene, I would just kind of play on my phone. Like,
when you saw it at the drive-in?
Yeah, the drive-in. Yeah, like, obviously, I would never do that at the theater.
I liked it because the audience I was in, they screamed.
They were into it?
They were like,
That's always fun.
It was like, and it was crowded on a Saturday night. So it was I don't know. I think it's worth mentioning that I feel like, because I was mixed about it the first time, and on second viewing, enjoyed it much better, which, you know, I think for horror movies, I think there's something to be said for that.
Yeah.
Because you know what's going to happen. All right, what else you got?
Okay, well, we both saw Mother.
Oh, no. Okay, now this is going to be a discussion.
Yeah.
You start, because this, you're the one that kind of explained to me what, like, it's like, oh, I feel like...
God, I don't want to get too in-depth
with
it.
Okay. It doesn't matter. First of all, no one saw the movie.
Yeah, and it's been out for weeks.
The spoilers are all on the internet. When you saw it, after we had a discussion, you said it's a religious allegory.
Yes, very much so.
I didn't notice that because I'm just not...
Yeah.
A particularly religious person, so
it got spoiled
at least
for
not
me.
Traditional
it got spoiled for me. I was reading a review of it, and they just flat out said that it was an allegory for the Bible, the creation story. Basically, Javier Bardem plays a character called Him, which is God, and Jennifer Lawrence plays, I don't know why I wanted to say Jennifer Lopez. Jennifer Lawrence plays a character called Mother. And she's rebuilding this house after this big raging fire that happens in the beginning scene. And all of a sudden, Ed Harris shows up, and he's called the Man in the movie. Like, that's the official name they gave him. And he's like this weird kind of creepy guy that really kind of hits it off with Javier Bardem's character. All of a sudden... Ed Harris's wife shows up, played by Michelle Pfeiffer.
And there is he Adam?
Yes, Adam
because
and Eve.
Because he's got like a...
He has the wound on the side.
And I was like, the wound? It's like, oh, Adam's rib.
Mm-hmm.
Ah,
yeah.
Okay, yeah.
And they have that crystal thing, which is basically the apple.
Right.
So he plays with the apple.
Oh.
Like, you know, God gets pissed off. Then their kids show up. Their kids murder each other, so it's a Cain and Abel thing.
Right.
And more people show up. There's more religious allegories. There's more religious stories that are touched upon. There's one scene where Jennifer Lawrence is trying to fix a sink, and the sink basically floods. So it's kind of a callback to Noah, which Darren Aronofsky directed Noah.
Which I liked. Let's say, I'm not a Bible fan, but Ten Commandments is pretty good.
I'm like that film. I'm a big fan of theology, actually, but
that stuff just went over my head, and I still enjoyed the movie for different reasons. But it's
visually stunning. It's well acted. It's a mindfuck movie. It's not conventional at all. It's not a conventional story.
Here's what I liked about it: the visual style that Darren Aronofsky used is it's never not moving.
Yeah,
the camera rarely settles.
Yeah,
rarely settles, and it's Jennifer Lawrence walking from this room to the next room, and it's kind of over the shoulder, and you're following her, and you follow her to the next thing. She's running around, and then she goes here, and then it's in the next room, so she's got to move. There's this sort of frenetic energy, and it never stops. There isn't a traditional scene where it's like, they have a scene and then a moment to breathe. There are no moments to pause and breathe in this. It's this relentless, which is why I think like it's it's unsettling to the viewer to see when is this movie going to, you feel like, when is the movie going to start? It never starts. And what I also love about it is it never once explains itself.
Yeah.
It never explains itself. So you telling me all this, it's like, oh, now I get it.
Yeah, so Javier Bardem is essentially playing God, and the movie makes a point to say that he's a poet and he's creatively stunted. So it examines the kind of the relationship between God and Mother Earth. Mother Earth, you see Jennifer Lawrence constantly give, constantly, you know, try to be a gracious host to these people that are constantly taking advantage of us, which is what humans do. We're constantly mining, we're constantly hurting the earth, we're constantly putting, you know, horrible gases in the air, that sort of stuff. And at a certain point, Javier Bardem kind of almost sides with the humans, like almost craves their praise and craves their adoration so much that he basically ignores Jennifer Lawrence.
Right.
And there's this really interesting, like, fucked up scene where Jennifer Lawrence becomes pregnant and she has a baby, and it's obviously, like, you know, a metaphor for Jesus, and Javier Bardem is telling her, you know, like, give me the baby, give me the baby, and Jennifer Lawrence is holding on to it, saying, no, I'm not going to give it to you. So Javier Bardem, like, waits until she falls asleep, and Jennifer Lawrence wakes up, and it's this incredible, like, almost, the only thing I can compare it to is Jacob's Ladder. She wakes up, and she sees the baby's gone, she stands up, Javier Bardem has her back to her, and all of a sudden, you see this crowd of people that are just filling up the house, throwing the baby in the air, and then the next, like, it cuts to the baby on an, like, you hear, like, the baby's, like, neck snap, and then the baby's on an altar. The humans are, like, eating the baby.
So it's talking
about, like, the crucifixion and the sacrifice of God, or of Jesus Christ and everything like that, and it's just a terrifying, like, it reminded me of the lizard woman scene in Jacob's Ladder, where it's just like, what the fuck is happening?
I mean, what's weird is that you're watching this and you're going, like, is this sort of a dark suspense thriller? Is it a horror film?
Yeah.
I mean, the trailer makes it look like Rosemary's Baby. It's not like Rosemary's Baby at all. It's not, that's not what this film is.
I agree.
It's, as you point out, it's like, this is the story of the Bible. It's just that because that was never hammered into me, because I, as a little kid, I remember only going to church at Christmas, which was like, all right, I'll do this boring shit because I get to open presents later.
Yeah.
So, I also, I went to catechism for like a minute because I quit because it conflicted with Lost in Space, which was on television.
And
Godzilla movies and everything else that I was into. I was not into God and religion so much. Living a good life, the Ten Commandments, I got those. I'm like, these are really good. I think these are good suggestions. I'll follow these.
Yeah.
Seems like a good idea. But other than that, I really, the religion just is, and I know it holds a lot of weight with a lot of people. And I feel like it's, religion for me is when it's used, say, in a movie like the original Omen.
Yeah.
It's so scary. Oh, I with love that,
the original Omen.
Love the original Omen. I mean, where they're chanting. And even the second one is pretty good. The third one is just ridiculous. But
I think the third one is better than the second one, to be honest.
Right. It's got Sam Neill. Kind of living the third one now, aren't
we? A little bit,
We're living the third one. It's, if you think about it, we are in the third Omen movie. It's a reality show called We're in the Fucking Third Omen Movie. What are we doing? We're all going to die. So, but
I come from the opposite perspective. I was raised in a very religious household.
We're not living.
No.
I'm saying
I was raised in a very religious household. I consider myself a Christian, not the type, like, we hang out all the time. I'm not pressing my beliefs on you.
Right.
I curse, I drink, like, I don't give a fuck. Like, it's just my personal.
You're saving yourself for your wedding night.
No. Oh, my grandma didn't hear that. I'm fascinated with theology, not just Christianity, but all religions.
Well, I enjoy reading about the history and also all the changes.
Yeah. Because
the Bible has changed in its writing so many times.
It's been tampered with too.
Tampered with and appropriated, you know, from other religions. And also, like, the thing that I used to love as a kid was, do you remember the Chick Tracks?
No.
Chick Tracks. Okay, Chick Tracks are these, they're sort of tiny comic books. They're about the size of like a
kid. And
Jack Chick was this sort of crazy illustrator who was not very good as an illustrator. And he would write these Chick Tracks and you would find them everywhere. You could buy them in boxes. I guess people would buy them in boxes and leave them places.
I found some at Comic-Con.
I would find them. I loved them. I thought they were so funny because the end of it was like, this person went out drinking, har har, and then someone would die, and then it'd be like the ending of it was always like, you know, the Grim Reaper, you're going to hell. It was always like, they were really cool, like little horror comics, but it was, and then it would have like passages from the Bible in it, and it would like be freaking scary because the Bible is something that I just, because it was never forced on me, it was always like, well, religion's an option, but you know, maybe
I'm not into that hellfire and brimstone.
Yeah,
bullshit.
I
was conflicted about ruining Mother, but you know what? I think Mother benefits from knowing what you're going into.
I wish I had known that. I actually think it would have enhanced the experience because then I wouldn't be waiting for the reveal. And what I do like about the movie is whenever there's a movie where there's like a mystery, right? Or a story where we don't know what people are talking about, and then suddenly it's revealed and it's like, it's never revealed.
Yeah.
There's never a moment where they go, this is what we're doing. Yeah. They just do it. So it's so, I mean, and also this movie, relative to a lot of other films out there, probably did not cost a whole lot of money.
No.
Not compared to the Noah movie that Darren Aronofsky did. I'm a huge Darren Aronofsky fan just from like, and it was so cool that in the press for this, they came out with like how he would have done Batman, sort of this badass. You didn't see that?
No, he was attached to Batman Year One for years. He was going to do years.
He was basically going to develop Batman. This is before Chris Nolan. And it was a Batman that I guess Frank Miller worked on it for a little bit. And Frank Miller was like, I think Aronofsky's taking it too far. Like,
that,
it'd be a much darker Batman where he's just,
That line in The Dark Knight, I'm not wearing hockey pads.
Yeah.
That's actually a reference to
Year One.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Because he was going to have like Batman as like this poor, like not a millionaire.
Right.
Or not a billionaire, like fighting crime and like kind of a makeshift Batman.
That would be, I don't know, I would like to see that. I think it
would have been cool.
Different. Just like when you read comics and they change the writing and illustrator team and the tone changes and the look changes and it's almost like this is what comic books do a lot is they reboot themselves. I mean, they reboot with like rebooting total universes. That was Anthony just sat back in the chair. And
I'm just going to stand up for a bit.
but when they do that, I love it because it's an opportunity for some new creative team to add a new layer to the mythos of that character. So,
put their spin on it.
When Kirby and Lee did the first 100 issues of the Fantastic Four, then there were different incarnations of the Fantastic Four. So I don't know. I like when that happens. I like someone being able to add something to it, especially these characters that have decades long of existence. You know, there has to be a refresh to it. So when there are movie reboots, I feel like, what are people complaining about? They do this in comic books all the time.
Yeah.
You know, it's popular. So, but I just feel Darren Aronofsky is one of those filmmakers like a David Lynch.
I'm a big fan of him.
Huge.
And I didn't care about The Fountain. I wasn't a big fan of Black Swan.
I love The Fountain, and I got the weirdest. I don't even know how I got it. I got a promo from The Fountain. Maybe it was from the DVD of it. A promo from The Fountain that is a snow globe, and I still have it to this day. Oh, I'll show it
to
you.
That's awesome. Yeah,
I'll show you the Fountain snow globe.
Yeah,
but So I think Aronofsky is just one of those filmmakers that every time out, whether it doesn't matter to me whether he hits a home run or the stupid basis by which we judge movies. I do not like the, even though we do it on Film Threat, because what we do on filmthreat.com, if you look at a reviewer's review, they choose how they want to rate movies. So everyone chooses their own system, 1 through 10, 1 through 5,
ABC. Technically 1 out of 9.
Yeah, one
I
out
never
of
gonna get no one's gonna,
yeah, but
yeah.
But
it's
the point is,
thing I don't care,
you know, it was really Siskel and Ebert, and this is what serious critics at the time, that Gene Siskel and Roger Ebert came up with their television show, in the 70s, Serious critics hated Siskel and Ebert because they reduced film criticism to thumbs up and thumbs down.
Yeah, that's the same argument that Rotten Tomatoes is getting now.
Oh, big thumbs up. Yeah, and Rotten Tomatoes is, first of all, I don't care about Rotten Tomatoes.
I don't either.
Even though Film Threat's reviews are included as part of Rotten Tomatoes scores, I don't care about, I don't, I
that's
feel
That's just
like,
a cool aside to me. It's not like a point of pride or anything.
I don't know.
It's just like, eh.
Yeah, yeah, well, but what I'm saying is that I don't like the whole ranking system we have for movies in terms of compare it against what, you know? I feel like I respect other people's personal taste and I'll find someone whose voice I like.
Yeah.
You know, not yours, but someone.
Ouch.
Who
you motherfucker.
No, but I'm just saying that like I identify with certain people's voices, but actually I almost prefer to like read people that disagree with my own opinion because I feel that I learned something.
Yeah.
But what Aronofsky is like one of those guys every time out of the gate, like who cares how much a movie makes? I feel like saying a movie made a lot of money isn't a badge of honor. It's not a thing that's like, it made a lot of money, so it's a good movie. But that's a conclusion that a lot of people make. A lot of, say, casual moviegoers say it made money, it must be good. That's not true.
Yeah. Mother has got terrible reviews.
Yeah, terrible.
Like, terrible.
Terrible reviews. Yeah. And, yeah.
I can't remember who reviewed it for our site, but they liked it.
Yeah. Who was it? Oh, my God.
I don't know. I'll look it up.
That was, yeah. But I
loved
it. Norman Gidney.
Was it Norm?
Yeah, it was Norm.
I loved it. The ending was fantastic. Basically, Mother Earth destroys humanity.
Right.
And God has to rebuild, and which, you know, kind of goes with Revelations and the apocalypse.
So what's going to, okay, so maybe this will give us some insight. What is supposed to happen? Like, because that's the one thing that would, like, just as a kid, memories of a kid, the thing that scared me most about the Bible was all that omen, you know, fire and brimstone, like the apocalypse and the rapture and just all that stuff about the end of the world. And I remember seeing a documentary as a kid, I think it was on PBS, about Nostradamus.
Oh, yeah.
And all the Nostradamus quatrains, right? Mm. So here I am, like, I think it was junior high or high school, and watching like this documentary about Nostradamus, and they would go through his quatrains, right? But it was all from the point of view of France. And he got Hitler's name off by one letter. It was Hister, right? And then there were all these other things. And they said that, like, the man, the one thing that scared me was the man in the blue turban would unite the Middle East against the world. That would be all-out nuclear war.
Mm-hmm.
That would last for decades. And then there would be, after that, 1,000 years of peace.
Yeah, there's a ton of different interpretations of how the world is going to end.
Right.
Just in Christianity alone,
here's how I think it's going to end. I'm going to be dead, and then it's over for me. I'm ending, and then there you go. My chapter will have closed.
If it's going to happen, I want it to be a surprise.
Oh my God.
To be honest, like I just want to look up and just like see either a bomb or an asteroid or something and just say, well, fuck. And then the end.
Yeah.
I
think it's going to be much more boring than we think. And by that, I mean, the apocalypse is not going to be a single event that it's like, oh, the apocalypse. I believe that it's going to be, when you look at it, especially like I'm a big Neil deGrasse Tyson fan. I love that guy. Especially whenever he live tweets movies. He's great because he picks apart the science, but he's also, you can tell he's a nerd. He loves this stuff. He's just awesome. I just got his book, which is about, I can't remember the name of the book, but it's basically astrophysics for people on the go, which is, it's basically science. If you just want to know the basics of science if you don't want to go into the full depth, you can at least speak with some intelligence about, and
if you want to sound smart at parties.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I want to do. So I think it's going to be as simple as just the carbon dioxide in the air is going to get worse. There's going to be more global climate change. It's not going to be big and dramatic because here's the problem. Now we're getting into science fiction-y stuff. We don't live long enough to notice change. Change is incremental. I'm talking about on a global scale with this blue marble.
Yeah, it's almost microscopically gradual.
It's gradual. It's 2 inches of beach. It's gradual. Now, on the scale of millions of years, continents shift and move and waters rise. And the thing that really scared me, as I read this thing from NASA, that they were saying that what would happen is, in addition to global climate change, which is real, because the Pentagon believes it's real, every scientist in the world believes it's real. It's, you know, and I guess that came out, was it Mobil or Chevron? One of those oil companies are like, yeah, it's real, but it's like too late. We have this infrastructure to make money. What are we going to do? Stop making money? And so who knows? There could be a giant class action lawsuit against the, you know, fuel manufacturers. Good luck with that. Yeah. But the thing is the change is incremental. So we're talking about in hundreds of years, yes, things will be different. But those people won't have noticed it because they will just be living in the time that they're in, where they're not going to notice that the whatever time you're in is what it is for you.
Yeah.
And maybe 500 years ago, that was different for, like, you know, like we do all sorts of dumb things. We buy all sorts of dumb things because we've been told that, like, we have to disinfect or deodorize parts of our body that who cares?
Yeah.
Like 100 years ago, they didn't give a shit. Right.
Yeah.
But here we are buying all these products.
I would even argue products. Like 40 years ago, they didn't give a shit.
Yeah, exactly. I would argue if you go to a convention that they don't care now. But
yeah,
but what I'm saying is that change is great. But the thing that really made me sad was they said that the amount of CO2 in the air will actually begin to diminish human intelligence so that people will be less smart.
I think we're there.
Because it's kind of like, have you ever seen the H.G. Wells Time Machine? The one from the 50s with Rod Taylor.
I've seen clips of it.
Okay. It's a fun science fiction movie.
It's well regarded.
It's for its time. The effects were great. And, I still have an affection for it, but really is this sort of like people are cattle and you have these characters, the Morlocks, that live underground and they're sort of a mutant version of humans. And then this sort of beautiful version of humans living in the fields are just cattle, but they're all dumb. Everyone, the Morlocks are beasts and the humans are just, you know, they're docile cattle, you know? So that's the thing that really made me sad was not only is our future the global climate change, all that is going to affect things, but we're going to be dumber. But I don't believe it's necessarily going to happen as quickly as scientists are saying. I feel it's happening and we're seeing it in our time, but it's incremental. It's in degrees, right? Because people have tried to criticize Al Gore for like, oh, this stuff, it's not happening. It's not, but I feel like you need to be an alarmist to actually affect change. Why? First of all, if you're still listening to this movie podcast where we went on a tangent about the apocalypse and how the world's going to end, congratulations. Be the first to email me at filmthreatgore@gmail.com. Give me your address and I'm going to send you a Film Threat t-shirt because you kept
kind of you.
Hearing it to the end. Because I feel like we go off on these asides and rants.
You go off on the asides and rants. Like I'm always on point.
Right. Well,
always.
Well,
100%.
You come with a list. I have a list of things I want to talk about. Here's my list. It's Star Trek rant, Star Trek Discovery rant.
See, the fact that you say rant like in your list, like rant, sets you up, yeah.
I know what I'm going to say. I'm just Star Trek Discovery rant. Darren Aronofsky's mother. Professor Martha, I have my list. Mm-hmm. And then at the bottom of the list, it says other indies that Anthony has seen.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe we should end on a positive note because if you're still listening to this, you survived the apocalypse of this episode.
Yeah. I think we have time for a couple of indies.
All right. Let's hear it.
Okay. So, these ones are very similar. They're both musical documentaries. The first one is called Turn It Around, The Story of East Bay Punk. It's a documentary. Can't talk. It's a documentary about the punk scene in Berkeley and the surrounding areas. It's a great doc, but at a certain point, it basically devolves into a Green Day documentary.
Green Day was part of that scene.
Yeah, yeah. As much as I like Green Day, like, I think the other aspects of the documentary were way more interesting. Like, I feel like, you know, Green Day had a Behind the Music on VH1. Green Day has had their, I think, their own kind of behind the scenes movies and stuff like that. Like, I know the story of Green Day, and I think most of the fans of Green Day know the story of Green Day, and I really wanted to see more of like the smaller bands and more of the scene and who was involved in the scene and who was promoting the shows and everything like that. You know, when most of the focus points to Green Day, it's them defending themselves after they left Lookout Records. People called them sellouts, and obviously you're not a sellout if you're becoming a successful musician. This is an argument we've heard throughout the years over and over and over again. It just seems like Green Day is protesting way too much. Like they take it a little too much to heart, and they should get over it, man. Like they've been successful for, you know, how many years? Like 20 years now. Just get over it. Nobody thinks you're a sellout anymore. I mean, you guys are sellouts, but you weren't sellouts back in the day when you guys are saying you sold out. As a fan of Green Day, I never held it against them that their music found mainstream success.
Well, music docs is, I mean, that's a genre unto itself. I remember going to, you know, like late night screenings of, you know, there were a couple Who documentaries.
Yeah.
Kids Are All Right. And Quadrophenia. I love those movies and music docs. And then there were all the punk rock ones where I was like too young to go see some of these bands because I was under 21. But when I was like 16 and had a car, I could go see all of these weird documentaries. It was the only way I could see bands like Oingo Boingo and
The Police. Oingo Boingo. Yeah.
The Police. Yeah. So I loved these music docs that just sort of, you know, were thrown out into the world, and that was a way to experience those bands. So music, I feel like we could do a whole episode just on music docs.
Oh, we totally should.
So where does this one rank? Like,
So the issues
I'm saying, where does it rank after I gave this whole rant about how ranking is stupid?
Yeah,
and we should. I'm just saying that I think that judging a movie based on money is not something I subscribe to. But but an opinion is an opinion. So
I mean, it's a very long film. I would say it's too long and it could have been trimmed. But if you're a fan of bands like Operation Ivy, Dead Kennedys, 7 Seconds, Jawbreaker, NoFX, Bad Religion, Rancid, Sam I Am, I love Sam I Am, Fugazi, and The Offspring, you'll get rewarded with various band members showing up as talking heads. If you're a punk fan like I am, I mean, I grew up being a little punk rock kid with blue hair. You know, I lived in a podunk mountain town in the Sierra Nevadas. I knew about the Berkeley scene. This was happening when I was a teenager, and it was happening way before I was a teenager. But like when I was a teenager, you know, like Rancid was still part of Gilman Street and stuff like that. Like I wanted to be a part of this, so it really struck a chord with me. I would rank it fairly high up there, but still, it's too long. The folk, when it becomes a Green Day centric film, it's hard for me to care because I just don't care about Green Day and them defending themselves about selling out. The other musical doc I watched, it's the weirdest. I would say it's the weirdest concert film I've ever seen. It's called Pearl Jam Let's Play 2, or it's called Let's Play 2. Yeah,
two like
TWO.
Let's Play 2?
Yeah.
So is there a Let's Play 1?
No. It's a baseball term, apparently, which gets me into my point. It's like one part concert film and one part like this weird love letter that, you know, lead singer Eddie Vedder made to the Chicago Cubs. Like, it's... I'm not a big sports fan, and I'm not a big baseball fan. I go to the Angels games because I live in Anaheim every once in a while, and I have a good time, but I don't follow baseball. But apparently Eddie Vedder, the lead singer of Pearl Jam, is a huge, huge Chicago Cubs fan. He grew up in Chicago. Like, there's footage of him as a kid, like, going to the games with his, you know, with his family and stuff like that. And then they'll show like a song that they played at the Wrigley Field. And apparently they're releasing an album that's just them playing at the Wrigley Field in 2016. From what little baseball knowledge I know, apparently the Cubs won the World Series last year after a big slump. Like,
what is this now? A sports podcast?
Yes, Chris, it's a sports podcast.
I'm complaining now.
Yeah, we're going after a new demographic. But the documentary does a good job of making you care, even though I didn't care. It was interesting. I mean, you see like this really passionate fan base basically dealing with years and years and years of losing and failing, but still having hope and still, you know, like it's a very tight knit community, and it's really cool. Like Eddie Vedder just walks around like he's a normal human guy, or not a normal human guy. He's obviously a human guy, but not a rock star, not one of the biggest, you know, most famous rock stars on the planet.
This is what I say when I walk around my neighborhood. I say, look at that normal human guy. I say, what? Can we just say we're very tired?
Yeah.
Because we've been doing too many podcasts in a row to kind of, we want to try to get ahead of the game here.
Yeah.
So if we're slacking, it's for your entertainment. That's why.
I think we've been doing a good job.
Okay.
But it's this, when I say it's weird, I'm not saying it's weird in a bad way. I found the documentary really cool. I'm a big fan of Pearl Jam as well. The music is amazing. Pearl Jam is one of those bands that are way better live than they are in the studio. So, I mean, the concert footage is just amazing. They have this really cool scene where they're talking to this fan that camps out 4 days early to see the Wrigley Field show. And he's, you know, like doing this interview where he's basically saying, like, you know, they had this moment where Pearl Jam played this song called Release, and it just made me think of, you know, my dad passing away, and like, you know, the guy like just starts crying. And at the concert, Eddie Vedder is on stage and he goes, you know, I heard about this guy who is going through some rough times and he's in the front row, and I just want to dedicate this song to him and his dad. And like, just watching like that fan interaction just made me think, like, Eddie Vedder is one of the nicest, coolest dudes on the planet, and if I ever get to meet him, I'm just gonna fucking hug him. Like, so it's cool, but I wouldn't, you know, I don't think it's
so, just don't hug him though, because it could be considered assault. It could be considered,
that's true.
You're trying, you can't.
I will ask him if I can hug him. How about that?
Yes, you could ask him for, I would say, a hearty hand clasp. I think that's probably better. There you go.
That works.
Start with that. Move up to a hug.
Yeah. If you're
if you're gonna do the hug, do like the one that's the shoulder to shoulder hug. That's kind of a, where you just don't, there's some people that I know that will hug where they're barely touching you and it feels a little awkward.
The hover
like,
hug.
Like to me, the hug where you come completely in, and especially with females, like I'm a little, not that I'm skittish, but it's like I don't want to feel anything from the front, so I'm awkward with that.
Fair enough.
Like, I like the hug. I like, and I've even had like female friends of mine comment and say, oh, I just get the pat, and then they'll like hug me, and I'm like, I don't want to be I'm weird about being touched by people that I'm not intimate with anyways. It just feels awkward to me. So but
fair
for the
enough.
Guy thing, just do the shoulder to shoulder, keep it not a lot of touching.
Nope. Full on hug.
You're going to do it?
Full on hug.
All right.
If I ever get the opportunity.
I warned you. Warned you.
Anyways, if you're a fan of Pearl Jam, you'll love it. If you're a fan of baseball, especially the Cubs, you'll also love it. For everybody else, though, you'll probably want to skip it. But
you know what?
I
you know what
it.
People are not going to love and are not going to give a good rating to on Rotten Tomatoes? This podcast. Because I
on
feel
Rotten Tomatoes?
On no, this podcast.
We're going to be on Rotten
Tomatoes. We're not on Rotten Tomatoes. Okay. I'm just saying that this episode of the show went off the rails. Well, it always goes off the rails because of me.
Yeah.
But I'm saying this particular episode went off the rails. We talked about religion. We talked about the apocalypse. We talked about sports. At some point we have to talk about movies. But I also think we have to wrap it up because we got to wrap it up. This is the show. This is the show this week.
That's all I have to say.
Great.
Well, about Pearl Jam, let's play too.
Well, I want to thank you for another great episode of the show, Anthony.
Thank you, Chris.
We were talking just before the show, not on the microphone, about how when Anthony first started, you should listen to those early episodes. They're unlistenable.
No, that's not true.
They're some of the worst podcasts. I'm talking about the early, early episodes of earlier this year, and just how you've come out of your shell and you've evolved into like opinionated. You say fuck you to my face. You don't actually use the words, but I can tell it's in your eyes. And so
I've said fuck you.
Well, actually, you have said
and
that.
I've called you a motherfucker.
But like, yeah, like, no, it's just just watching you evolve and doing this, it's like, you know, it's you are great on the show, and I really enjoy recording this with you. It's like a fun, it's like getting together with a friend and just BSing about movies, and we kind of save it for like, no, let's not talk, we don't talk about it during the week, we get together, and then it just all unloads.
That's what makes the show fun for
me. So thank you, Anthony. And we also want to thank our sponsor, VideoBlocks.
Yep.
VideoBlocks.com. Go there for your stock footage, audio, special effects. It is the filmmaker's toolkit. It's like, for me, looking at like, just looking at what you're able to get for $149 a year, it's like giving a boost to your productions. It's like having a movie studio at your disposal, the resources that they have. So go to videoblocks.com/filmthreat. It helps support this show. We want to thank them for coming on as a sponsor.
Absolutely.
So, cool. And you know what we got to do? Yeah.
We got to get out of here. Let's get out of here.
Let's get out.
Guy.